Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast. Good afternoon. It's the show on KJZZ. I'm Mark Brody in Phoenix. Look for partly sunny skies for the rest of the afternoon with a high of 107. About a 10% chance we see some storms this afternoon. Chance of rain increases to 30% by tonight with overnight lows in the mid to upper 80s. Partly cloudy again for tomorrow with a high of 108. Still a slight chance for some storms. Right now in Phoenix, under mostly sunny skies, it's 101 degrees. In Valley traffic on the 60 eastbound, watch for a crash on the Higley Road on-ramp. High-ranking members of the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office will head to court on Friday, where lawyers are expected to argue they should not face criminal contempt referrals for failing to follow a judge's orders. As KJZZ's Matthew Casey reports from the West Valley Bureau, attorneys for Chief Deputy Jerry Sheridan argue in a memo that prosecution isn't necessary because Sheridan's career is already on the line.
Sheridan's lawyers say he did not willfully violate a federal court order, which is a key element needed to refer someone for criminal contempt. But Judge G. Murray Snow has ruled the opposite, finding in May that Sheridan intentionally violated court orders and lied under oath. Sheridan's attorneys say he was unaware of the details of a preliminary injunction blocking deputies from detaining people solely on suspicion of their immigration status. The attorneys say it was not Sheridan's job to implement it, and he did not open, forward, delete, or print an email that contained a copy of it. Sheridan has long acknowledged that he failed to follow Snow's order. His lawyers say civil contempt penalties are enough because internal investigations could lead to him being fired, which would affect his pension and end his 38-year career. Matthew Casey, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Rainy weather is working in favor of firefighters combating the Fuller Fire near the north rim of the Grand Canyon. As much as a quarter inch of rain fell over the area, helping strengthen existing fire lines. Michelle Fiddler with the Kaibab National Forest says the additional rain, and more expected today, will help with containment efforts.
We do expect to continue to reduce new fire growth. Firefighters are starting mop-up operations, so they're looking to kind of seek and destroy any hot spots near our existing fire perimeter control line.
The lightning-caused fire has burned more than 14,000 acres since it began 3 weeks ago. Acting as a prescribed burn, it's still considered 0% contained. The second day of the Republican National Convention figures to be less dramatic than the first, when some delegates during the afternoon session noisily called for a roll call vote on the convention's rules. That request was denied. KJZZ's Jude Joffe Blanc is in Cleveland for the RNC convention, and she joins me. And Jude, on the issue of rules, it seems the story of Arizona's Lori Hack, who was elected as a delegate and then had her credentials revoked, seems like that story is not over yet.
Right. I was surprised because I was walking the halls of the Quicken Loans Arena. There was a big media scrum about some of the contentious stuff that happened on the floor. And there was Lori Hack. And I didn't realize she was going to be able to get in. But she doesn't have the delegate credential from Arizona, but she has a pass to be in the arena. And there she was. And she's working with one of these groups trying to unbind delegates. And it seems like that fight is over. There's nowhere else to go, from what I understand. But there might still be ways that they can make noise or voice dissent. So we'll be looking for that to happen. She still seems quite upset that her delegate credential was revoked by the Arizona Party Chair, Robert Graham. And it seems like she might not be done fighting on that front. Not sure where that will go, though.
Jude, there are a lot of obviously well-known politicos in Cleveland, but for Arizona, one of the biggest known politicos is Maricopa County Sheriff Joe Arpaio, with whom you have a report. You've reported on him for quite a while. He is in the building, right?
That's right. Well, Sheriff Joe Arpaio was elected to be a delegate from Arizona, and he's been making quite an impression at this convention. You know, just walking around with the sheriff, people are stopping him, wanting to take photos with him. If you're standing anywhere near him, people will hand you their cell phone and ask you to take a picture. This happened to me. You know, it's amazing. He can't really walk a few feet without this happening. There was a mixer yesterday with the Arkansas delegation, and one of those delegates came up to me and said, if Sheriff Arpaio wanted to run for office in our state, you know, if he wanted to be governor, he could do it. He's so popular there. So there was definitely, at least among Arkansas Republicans at the convention, a lot of enthusiasm, and he's been doing a lot of national media as well while he's here.
Jude, what is on the agenda for tonight?
Tonight's theme is Make America Work Again, so it's jobs related, and we'll be hearing from a number of the members of the Trump family and also some high-profile Republicans. So this is Senate Majority Mitch McConnell's turn to talk, as well as House Speaker Paul Ryan. We'll be hearing from them, and that's, of course, interesting given that, you know, so many members of the Republican Party and sort of people associated with mainstream establishment Republican politics are not present.
That's KJZZ's Jude Joffe Block reporting from the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. For another perspective on yesterday's rules wrangling, I'm joined by GOP political consultant Constantine Carrard, who's one of Arizona's delegates. He was a Ted Cruz supporter, but will now vote for Trump. And Constantine, why did some delegates think the rules should have been set aside this one time?
There were a number of rules that had been pushed through that weren't very good rules. They had some good rules as well. I mean, the Rules Committee did some good work as well. But I think the media has characterized this as either Trump versus anti-Trump, which is probably an easy storyline. And I think it's what a certain number of delegates thought was going on. But in truth, the fact it wasn't a question of Trump or not Trump. There were a number of other rules that the delegates wanted to see changed. The idea is basically if you turn down the rules, it sends it back to the Rules Committee, and they know they need to bring you an improved product so that you can approve the improved product.
Would something done by the Rules Committee, though, really be able to overturn the Arizona law, which binds delegates on the first ballot?
No, and again, I think that's the narrative that causes the misunderstanding. There was no attempt to do that. There were a number of rules that were offensive to the delegation. For instance, the RNC was pushing a rule so that Rules Committee members' contact information would not be shared in the convention 4 years from now. It wouldn't be shared with the members of the Rules Committee until they got to wherever the next convention was, because they didn't want Rules Committee members getting organized and talking to each other in advance. Well, that's great if you're the RNC trying to consolidate control over the committee, but if you think the committee ought to be working things out ahead of time and making plans and actually communicating, you wouldn't want a rule like that in place. So there were a number of rules like that which actually were what the fight was about. But because the rules are a take it or leave it, you have to pass them all or reject them all. And it became really easy for the narrative to exist that somehow this was all about, you know, unbinding delegates or about Donald Trump, when it really was just about a number of other rules.
I imagine this is not your first convention. Have you seen something like this happen before, this kind of public rules fight, not just in the Rules Committee?
Yeah, it's not terribly uncommon. They had it 4 years ago when the Romney delegation was trying to ensure that Ron Paul wouldn't speak. It's not uncommon, but it drives people crazy every time.
Would it have been better, do you think, to just do the roll call vote, have it, see what the results are, and then move on from that?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, the idea behind the roll call vote was to ensure that you wouldn't have a scene on the floor. In other words, if you give people a vote and they win the vote or they lose the vote, you know, everybody feels like the process was fair. You might be happy because you won or you lost, but in a fair process, you know, we're civilized, we proceed on to the next item. Where people get upset is, again, where the process is hijacked or the rules are ignored. In this case, to make sure that they recognized your right to a roll call vote, you had to submit written petitions from a number of states. And the RNC basically said, okay, well, you know, they were going delegation to delegation trying to twist arms to get people to unsign petitions. And at the end, they claimed that enough people had unsigned that you didn't have the minimum number of states. But even today, the RNC still won't release the names of the people who they claim unsigned. And so you have no way of knowing that the process was legitimate. And that's just not how Republicans function.
Do you think what happened yesterday afternoon will affect the rest of the convention and maybe affect the rest of this election on the Republican side?
No, there's generally not a lot of lingering damage that would impact the next election. What it does, unfortunately, is it increases the friction within the party. So it's the kind of thing that will come up at the next county meeting in Arizona or the next state meeting in Arizona or elections to the RNC. It'll be something that people 4 years from now will be anticipating. and it feeds a distrust between the grassroots and the establishment folks that run the RNC. And that's just, that's corrosive over the long term for a party.
Constantine Carrard is an Arizona delegate at the Republican National Convention in Cleveland. Constantine, thanks.
You bet. Have a great day.
Today, the Department of Corrections is beginning to move medium security prisoners from state facilities to the privately run Red Rocks Correctional Center in Eloy. KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins joins me with more on this. And Jimmy, what's the reason for the move?
Well, the state is running out of room. The state prisons are crowded, and there seems to be no interest in building a new state prison. So Arizona continues to look to private companies to house offenders.
Well, who owns this prison in Eloy, this Red Rock Correctional Center?
Red Rock is owned by the Corrections Corporation of America. They also own the Eloy Detention Center, which was the site of the recent measles outbreak. Other private facilities have been the site of riots over abusive treatment and medical neglect, but the state continues to contract with the private groups to house its prisoners.
How much does this all cost?
The state is paying CCA $66 per inmate per day for these inmates that are being transferred to the center in Eloy.
Is that cheaper than how much it would cost to house them in a state prison?
Well, that's a contentious issue. In the most recent study available, the Department of Corrections found if you look at daily costs but don't factor in health care costs, private prisons are cheaper. But if you include medical costs, state-run facilities are cheaper. But we don't have any recent data comparing the two because the Department of Corrections no longer shares the studies. The legislature actually repealed a law requiring the release of the data.
So, Jimmy, are these prisoners that are being moved starting today, is this a permanent move for them?
Yes, these are so-called permanent beds. The Department of Corrections was attempting to deal with overcrowding by adding temporary beds to cells at state prisons, but Andrew Wilder with DOC says that's not really a sustainable practice.
Ultimately, you don't want to add too many because that can mess with the staff ratio, which you really don't want to go beyond certain amounts to in order to maintain safe and secure operations.
So will this fix the overcrowding problem?
Only temporarily, I think. Wilder told me their latest projections show DOC taking in 75 more prisoners a month than they'd expected. So while there are 1,000 new beds at Red Rock, they're all already spoken for.
That's KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Thanks, Jimmy.
My pleasure, Mark.
It's the show on 91.5. Thanks for listening today. Along with the Takeaways, John Hockenberry, I'm Mark Brody. Perhaps the most pressing issue for the U.S. regarding instability in Turkey is determining the status and safety of NATO's largest nuclear weapons arsenal. The Incirlik Air Base in southeastern Turkey, which has been active since the invasion of Iraq in 2003 and is currently conducting airstrikes in Syria, is just about 70 miles from the Syrian border.
The bombs are part of an unintentional Cold War museum, though, left over from the 70s and 80s. There aren't even any aircraft capable of delivering those nuclear weapons stored at Incirlik. So why are they even in Turkey, and who's responsible for them? Eric Schlosser is the author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, the Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety.
We're talking about hydrogen bombs. The estimates are there are about 50 American hydrogen bombs stored at the Incirlik air base in Turkey, and the power was immediately cut off to that base. All flights in and out of the base were shut down, and it's a pretty unusual situation to occur at a facility with that many nuclear weapons, with any nuclear weapons, really.
Forgetting for the moment, or putting aside for the moment, the sense of what are the rules for Turkey regarding those nuclear weapons, what is NATO's set of rules regarding the security and storage of those nuclear weapons? Can any NATO nation, take them out, check them out, like in the library or something?
Well, they're not supposed to. We have American nuclear weapons in five countries in NATO, and technically they're American weapons, and they're only supposed to be taken out and used with our permission. The problem is that at these bases, the security of these weapons for these weapons is provided by the host country. Now, Belgium, for example, has been recently a hotbed of ISIS activity, and yet at an air base in Belgium, we have nuclear weapons. There was a major security breach at that air base in 2010 when some peace activists were able to sneak into the base, sneak into the buildings where the nuclear weapons were stored, and wander around. And when they were finally caught, They were caught by a Belgian soldier whose rifle seemed to be unloaded from the YouTube video that was posted online. So, you know, we really need to remember that these nuclear weapons are there and maybe have a national dialogue about why they're there and how well they're being protected.
Barring that dialogue, is there any monitoring of the weapons from the United States or from the Pentagon, or is it a matter of you have to call up the base and ask somebody if they know where all the nukes are?
Well, I'm sure it was a very tense situation in Turkey because, you know, the United States at that air base has the Air Force has planes, and we've been flying missions against ISIS. It's worth keeping in mind that the Incirlik base is only about 70 miles away from Syria and from a rebel-controlled area of Syria where ISIS is active. Now, we have planes at that base, and we have a munitions support group that's supposed to be looking after the weapons, but it's not a very large group of American forces there versus, you know, how many Turkish soldiers are on that base. As of yesterday, the power was still cut off at the base. They're a symbol of American support for Turkey, for NATO. The problem is they're not just symbols, they're actual weapons. And there's real concern that they could fall into the wrong hands.
One of these hydrogen bombs that you've described could be deployed in a very customized basis. And I'm just wondering, you know, is this an ideal kind of a weapon for a terrorist?
Well, you know, any nuclear weapon would be an ideal weapon for a terrorist. These hydrogen bombs, they're called B-61 bombs, have a special dial a yield feature. So depending on the mission, you can have them by rate of comparison. The bomb that destroyed Hiroshima had the explosive force of about 15,000 tons of TNT, so 15 kilotons. The bombs that are in Turkey range anywhere from 3/10 of a kiloton to 170 kilotons, so more than 10 times more powerful than the Hiroshima bomb. And it's hard to see what their actual military mission would be. I mean, if you really want to strike a target in the year 2016 quickly, you use a missile. A missile is faster. A missile is more reliable because it can't be shot down, and a missile is more accurate.
Finally, is it widely understood in southern Turkey and in Syria that those weapons are there?
Absolutely. It's widely understood in Turkey that they're there. And one of the real problems is that when the Cold War ended, in the American public in particular, there was the sense that this nuclear danger went away. But it never really did, and there are still thousands of these weapons out there. And we need to really think about where they're being kept, how they're being kept, and whether we still need them there.
Eric Schlosser is the author of Command and Control, Nuclear Weapons, The Damascus Accident, and the Illusion of Safety. A film based on that book will be out in September. Eric, thanks so much.
Thanks for having me.
That's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Chile is the world's biggest copper producer. The red metal accounts for more than half its exports, and the country has enjoyed booming prices for decades. But Chile's fortunes are tied to China, and as its economy has slowed down, the world price of copper has plunged more than 20%. Bad news for big producers in Chile, and even worse for the 27,000 or so people who work in small privately owned mines. The BBC's Jane Chambers went to the north of Chile to find out how they're coping with the crisis.
High up in the mountains, along a dirt track road that takes you past fields of goats enclosed by fences made of cactus, you'll find the San Andres copper mine, and I'm off to meet the owner.
My name is Elder Olivares Marin, and we are in the Ovalle region. This is a small mine. I only have 4 people working for me, and we don't use much machinery. I started out with just a shovel and a wheelbarrow, and it was really tough, backbreaking work. But I love it. I like being outside and the adrenaline you get from being in a mine, and the fact that I work for myself. It's very rare for a woman to be a miner, but I've never had any problems.
So we're just walking into the mine to have a look at some of the things that they're mining. There's copper here, tunnels. It's quite cool in here.
Look, this tunnel carries on going for around 160 metres. We have 2 types of copper that we're mining for. oxide, which you can see just above your head, and sulfide, which you will find further down.
And what about the prices in China?
The truth is that they are having a very bad effect on us. Unlike many miners who are leaving the industry, I'm too old to find another job, so I just have to get on with it and wait until prices get better. At the moment, we are barely breaking even, and it's tough to find enough money to pay my workers every month. I've wanted to buy my own house for years, but I'll just have to keep renting.
The next mine that we are off to see now is Santa Alicia, which is owned by a group of brothers who set it up and founded it together. It's a small copper mine. It's got about 40 people working there.
My name is Alamiro Zúñiga Pizarro, and this mine is near a town called Punitaqui.
You've been a miner for 33 years. You've been working here for the last 8 years. What would you say conditions are like now for miners?
Well, the price of copper is essential to what we do. The best price we ever got was around $4 a pound, and that meant me and my brothers could set up this mine and buy all the machinery we needed. Now, with prices at around $2.30, we just have to get on with it. We've never stopped when the going gets tough. There are some miners that we call the swallows, because like the birds, they come and go according to the price of copper. When prices are bad, they will go and work in farming or some other kind of job. But this is all we know how to do.
About an hour's drive away in the seaside resort of La Serena, the state-run mining company Anami has one of its offices. It's their job to help with the development of small to medium independent copper mines in Chile. When I met their regional manager, Alexis Mendez, he explained why the smaller copper mines are so vulnerable.
The main reason is because they aren't run by big businesses with lots of money to invest. Often, there are only 5 to 7 people working in the mine, and everything is done on a much smaller scale. When the prices are good, they can invest in machinery and live well. But when prices drop, they barely break even. That's why we, at Enami, we subsidize them when times are rough.
In small mines like these, just a few cents can make all the difference to whether a mine and a community will survive or not. Although they're thousands of miles away, their lives are dangerously linked to China's economic outlook. And for now, they can only hope that it's beginning to recover.
That's the BBC's Jane Chambers.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5. I'm Mark Brody with Steve Goldstein.
Listening to radio is often a community experience, the place where people turn for the latest news, conversation, and deeply personal stories. And that stretches to all varieties of communities in the U.S. As part of that, the Valley began hosting a tribal radio summit today as a way to get Native Americans and people who live in tribal communities involved in owning and managing radio outlets. Lori Taylor is president and CEO of Native Public Media, and she's with me to talk about the summit. Lori, how important is radio to tribal communities? Is it as important as it is to people who don't live in those areas?
I think when you come from a community like mine, which is on the Hopi Reservation, and you don't have running water or electricity or, for today's platform, broadband, then it becomes incredibly easy to understand why radio is the medium of choice. If you have a community where you still have dirt roads and where infrastructure is late in coming to your community and where the rest of America is wired already and where you still have darkness in terms of technology, then radio is really a medium that reaches every household. All you need is a small radio. It could be battery operated. It could be run by electricity. But in any event, you can reach the entire community. The entire reservation can be connected.
Do you want to get more people? Do you want to encourage more people to not just be on the radio, but actually be involved potentially in management and ownership situations?
Well, I think Native Public Media's work is about three things. It's about access, it's about control, and it's about ownership. Mm-hmm. It basically comes down to this. If you don't tell your own story, somebody else will. And we've experienced this in many different ways. I mean, you've seen the Western movies where there are Indians and cowboys, and perhaps stories about Native Americans written by other folks. Or at the worst, it could be invisibility. We see this in textbooks all the time, where perhaps a sentence or a paragraph is dedicated to Native Americans, but not much else. And so there's this huge void, unfortunately. Across the United States, there are 567 Native nations, all very diverse, all with their own languages and cultures, very rich in that way. But very little is known by the average American about Native Americans. And so in terms of access, we're talking about access to infrastructure, to capital with which to build the studios, to markets where large populations of Native Americans reside. In terms of control, we're talking about programming and content, having control about our own image, about our own stories, really being the writers of our own history. Owning the pen is what that's about.
Do you feel as though the Native American tribes are playing catch-up in the sense that because other people have been telling the story for so long, that it's not just, hey, it's time for us to tell our story. It's more like, well, first we have to knock down the old stories and then build up our own real story.
I think it's definitely both of those things. I think we have, in terms of technology, back in 2000 and 2000, the early 2000s, broadband penetration, anecdotally, according to the FCC, was around 10%. Mm. In 2016, we're thinking it might be around 30% or more. So there's a lot of darkness across Indian country. We're simply not wired in terms of broadband. Mm. While the rest of the United States may have migrated over to digital platforms, we're still trying to get analog terrestrial stations out to tribal homelands because that's how pervasive the darkness is. And that has implications on not just media, but in other areas as well. It hurts our economy. Mm-hmm. It hurts our public safety.
Lori Taylor is president and CEO of Native Public Media. The Tribal Radio Summit, hosted by ASU's Cronkite School, started today.
In KJZZ News at 2:36, a team of astronomers led by the University of Arizona has confirmed the existence of 100 planets outside our solar system. The original discovery came via NASA's K2 space telescope. From the Arizona Science Desk, Sarah Hammond reports.
Scientists say at least four of the planets may have rocky features similar to Earth's and are orbiting a star less than half the size of our sun. Ian Crossfield of the U of A's Lunar and Planetary Lab says the findings will open the door for further study of the newly discovered bodies, all more than 100 light years away from Earth.
We might care about them because we might be interested in knowing how solar systems and planets like our own formed, so putting our own home here in the cosmos into a better, firmer context in terms of understanding our place in the universe.
Crossfield led the international team that confirmed the planet's existence using telescopes on Earth. Crossfield says astronomers hope to employ a new telescope in continuing their examination of this group of planets. The telescope is called the James Webb Space Telescope, and it is scheduled to launch in late 2018. In Tucson, I'm Sarah Hammond.
Raising children has its highs and lows, but there's one number parents can call when their baby hasn't stopped crying for hours on end or their toddler is having trouble adjusting to daycare, the Birth to Five helpline. And the experts who answer those calls at Valley Nonprofit Southwest Human Development have heard it all. The show's Lauren Gilger takes us there.
Well, it sounds like you're really in tune to her. And
if being a new parent is the hardest job in the world, as they say.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Then the four women in this room may have the second hardest.
Well, let me ask you this. Is she on any type of schedule regarding how many hours she goes in between feedings right now?
Every day, from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m., anyone, parents, grandparents, teachers, caregivers of any kind, can call the Birth to Five helpline and get their questions answered.
We get calls about child development. We get calls about kids who
aren't sleeping. When a child doesn't sleep, nobody sleeps.
Allison Steyer is the director of mental health services at Valley nonprofit Southwest Human Development, which runs the helpline.
Questions about what's coming next in development and how to support development, worries about parenting.
The helpline is celebrating its 10th year of operation this year, and that means they've heard it all, Steyer says.
We get a fair amount of freakouts. Yeah.
And these days, when Googling can make parents more confused and there are countless books on parenting, she thinks talking to an expert is more necessary than ever.
I mean, in a way, there's no handbook. In a way, there's a million.
New parents in Arizona are sent home from the hospital with a kit, and in it, there's a magnet with a number on it, the Birth to Five helpline, with their catchphrase below, nothing out of the question. And they mean nothing.
One mom called asking, what shall I do because my I think it was less than 2-year-old, just ate a fly. And I can understand, you know, maybe I will call too, I don't know.
Claudia Tisopoulos is an early childhood specialist who's worked answering calls at the helpline for 5 years.
You never know what you're gonna get.
She says she gets a lot of questions about tantrums, sleep problems, potty training, but the calls can also catch her off guard.
A grandma called, and she called to ask question how to tell her granddaughter that her mom passed because she was in Iraq.
This time, she stayed on the phone for a long time.
We talk about, you know, some ways that she can think about her mom and tell her for a four-year-old way that she's not coming back.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Sometimes callers call and it sounds very simple at first.
Like how many ounces in a bottle for a 2-month-old, Steyer says.
It sounds simple, and sometimes it is. But sometimes people bury the lead. And when you invite them to talk more about their parenting experience, when you create a space for that, you sometimes hear the kind of quiet desperation of parents.
And that's why Tisopoulos says the best thing she can give to a worried caregiver is her time.
A lot of people, you know, they don't have many friends or relatives or just even someone that they can talk to and tell their concerns, you know. They just want someone out there that they don't know to express their situations. And, yeah, they open up and they're really grateful for that time.
In Phoenix, Lauren Gilger, KJZZ News.
As of July 1st, the Arizona Geological Survey officially moved in with the University of Arizona. But that move also comes with a loss of funding, meaning the survey has to find grants and contracts and implement fees for its services. That has some officials worried about their ability to continue providing those services, including earth fissure mapping. Lee Allison is the state geologist and the director of the Arizona Geological Survey.
We're having to reprioritize all of the activities that we carry out. Our mission and state statutes remains pretty much identical to what it was as a state agency. So we have a long list of state services that we're mandated to carry out, but now our job is to find money from outside the state and outside the university to pay for those services.
And one of the things it looks like that you're not going to be able to do anymore is mapping fissures, which are these large sort of breaks in the earth.
Right. Our earth fissure mapping program has been around for 10 years now, and it's one of the things that we're going to have a challenge finding funding for a year from now to keep it going. We're hopeful that with the shortfall of funding that we have this current year, that we're going to be able to maintain at least a basic level of the earth fissure program, along with things like running the seismic monitoring network to record all the earthquakes in the state. But a year from now, when our one-time university funding goes away, we're not sure where the money's going to come from to continue mapping and mitigating earth fissures.
Given the practical use of those maps, I mean, we've heard about developers using them and realtors using them and homebuyers using them. Wouldn't one or some of those groups be able to come up with some money to continue this process?
Well, that's the question that we have to raise right now. The universities proposed a year-long process here of figuring out how to charge fees for some of the services we provide. And that's clearly one of the areas that we have to take a look at. As you mentioned, home buyers, developers, local planners use our site, and we may get as many as 100,000 visitors a year to our interactive online Earth Fisher maps. But the question is, are people willing to pay for those services, and how much? So at this point, we don't know.
How much money would you need to continue providing that service?
Well, we've scaled back our Fisher mapping program over the last several years because of the shortfall in state funding. But we were actually running a little bit ahead of schedule, so that we've completed all of the Earth Fisher mapping statewide here in the last year or two. But new fishers are forming. Existing fishers are growing. We're discovering fishers that we hadn't seen before. So right now, I'd say a maintenance level of about $50,000 a year is what we're anticipating for this current fiscal year. And I'm going to anticipate that going forward, we could probably maintain the maps and stay on top of new fishers or changes in existing fishers for roughly that amount.
What will the impact be on the state of not having updated maps going forward?
Well, this is a concern. When you look at the impacts on individual houses or developments, we've seen the value of a house diminish as much as 60% when it was discovered there were earth fissures under it that they hadn't recognized when they were building it. Fortunately, we haven't lost any homes to fissures opening up during a monsoon rain. We've seen yards disappear and corrals disappear, but we actually haven't had a house break in half. So as development continues or some older fissures are reactivated, we have the potential for houses to be completely destroyed.
Lee Allison is the Arizona State Geologist and Director of the Arizona Geological Survey. Lee, thanks.
My pleasure. Anytime.
The National Park Service turns 100 in August. The centennial should be an occasion to celebrate, but the milestone comes at a time when parks are understaffed and are struggling with a $12 billion maintenance backlog. So park superintendents are worried about the next century and who's going to visit and pay to maintain the nation's crown jewels. From KJZZ's Fronteras desk in Flagstaff, Laurel Morales reports.
In a video his friend took, 17-year-old Cheo Pitchford stands on a rock ledge, building up the nerve to jump into the muddy brown river several feet below. He's not your typical national park demographic. He's young, and his family comes from all over the world, including Europe and a Native American tribe. Cheo rode a Greyhound bus for 12 hours from Los Angeles to Flagstaff to go on this river trip through the Grand Canyon. Cheo says it's experiences like this that will leave a lasting impression on the way he thinks about national parks.
I think they're really important. It just allows people to appreciate nature more because, in the cities, all the trees are the same tree. It's always palm trees or, that bushy tree. But when you go in nature, you see, massive trees are bigger than buildings. It's just, the world outside of the cities are different than what you think. So it's just mind-opening.
Historian Wallace Degner called national parks the best idea we ever had. Absolutely American, absolutely democratic. They reflect us at our best rather than our worst. But Interior Secretary Sally Jewell says the Park Service hasn't succeeded in reaching people like Cheo. Jewell recently told a group of conservationists a record 307 million people visited national parks last year.
And the people visiting the parks? Still the baby boomers. The majority of visitors to national parks today look like me, older and whiter.
Jewell's on a mission to get youth and people of color hooked, too. The Park Service is doing that through youth employment efforts like the Latino Heritage Initiative Program and through TV ads like this one.
It belongs to everyone. It can be a place, a feeling, a state of mind. So get up, get out there, and find your park.
Leading up to the centennial, President Obama used the Antiquities Act to mark historical achievements with monuments dedicated to Cesar Chavez, Harriet Tubman, the Buffalo Soldiers, and other American heroes of color. But for diverse communities to actually go to national parks and monuments, Emma Wharton says we have to start asking more questions.
You know, what are your barriers to wanting to come to a national park? Is it financial? Is it that wilderness is something that is not of interest to you?
Wharton directs Grand Canyon Youth, a nonprofit that's asking those questions and getting kids who may not otherwise have exposure to the wilderness to national parks in the Southwest. Her organization reaches out to youth in rural parts of the country and inner cities where national parks aren't usually on the radar. But park officials offer a limited number of river trip permits to programs like this one. Most permits go to commercial boating companies, individual boatmen, and researchers.
I think a lot of times experiences like a river trip through Grand Canyon, they're very limited for either people who know how to do it, like in a private trip sort of setting, or a commercial where you're paying, you know, an outfitter for an experience. And that parks have decisions to make about how do different people get to access those places.
People like Cheo Pitchford. Without Grand Canyon Youth, he might never have had this experience jumping into the Colorado River at the base of the Grand Canyon.
Oh!
Laurel Morales, KJZZ News, Flagstaff.
It's the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. In the animal kingdom, getting a good grip can be the difference between eating a nice meal and being the meal. And perhaps no creature has perfected the grip better than the gecko. Todd Bookman from our partners at WHYY's Pulse recently sat down with one of the scientists credited with helping discover just how the gecko sticks.
These days, she's in charge of her own lab full of undergraduates.
Yeah, my name's Tanya Shea. I am an assistant professor at Temple University.
But when Shea was herself an undergraduate at UC Berkeley, she found herself delving deep into the world of lizard feet.
Well, so gecko feet are really cool. If you look at the tips of their toes, they have these toe pads, which really look like little layers of scales, basically. But when you go and you stick that under a microscope, it actually turns out that those little scales are actually made up of thousands of little tiny hairs. And if you go and get really crazy and blow them up way too large, what you actually find is the tips of those little hairs are actually broken up into even tinier little split ends.
Exactly how they use those split ends to stick, though, wasn't clear to researchers. They knew it wasn't suction or some sort of Velcro action or an adhesive. Instead, the leading gecko theorists of the day suspected something called van der Waals forces, named after a Nobel Prize-winning Dutch physicist.
Right, yeah, so van der Waals forces, it's one of those topics that, you know, we sort of cover in maybe high school chemistry for about a split second, then move on. And what it really is it's literally the weakest of all the chemical bonds, and it's caused by an overlap of electron clouds between two materials. So basically what we were saying was that potentially could it be that the way a gecko sticks is by bringing its foot so close to a surface that the electron clouds on its feet overlap with that of the material, which sounds just completely ludicrous.
The thing is, nobody had ever measured these gecko van der Waals forces before, put an actual number on it. So Shay, at the age of 21, when all of her friends were out at keg parties, she's getting down to business.
Well, I plucked little hairs off of these little tiny hairs that are about a tenth the diameter of human hair off the toes of these lizards and stuck them to, actually, it was a very, very simple force measuring device. It was literally just a little silver wire, a very thin piece of silver wire.
So picture it. Shay in a windowless laboratory, staring through a microscope, trying to get a gecko hair to interact with a wire so it could produce these van der Waals forces. It did not go smoothly.
Oh, no. I spent months and months and hours and hours and hours until like 3 or 4 o'clock in the morning sitting in this little dark lab, you know, by myself, taking these little hairs that I knew were supposed to stick to things and pushing up against this little piece of wire, and it would do absolutely nothing. It was basically like tapping, you know, a pen against a wall.
But then she finally figured out the problem.
And what I realized was we actually had to push it up against the surface and pull it down. And what that does is that actually engages it on the surface of this little piece of wire. And then once it's engaged, that thing pulls like mad. It's out of control, the amount of adhesion one little piece of hair can produce.
In fact, later research would find that these hairs could help a gecko hold many, many times its own body weight. These lizards are champs when it comes to hanging tight. Since Shea and her colleagues published their research 16 years ago in the journal Nature, the paper has been cited more than 1,800 times. And other teams have taken up the task, trying to manufacture products based on the toe hair properties. She thinks it may only be a few years before some sort of gecko tape hits the consumer market. And when it does, all those hours Shea spent in that gloomy lab trying and failing will be to thank.
Sometimes science is just bang your head monotonous.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. That's what a large part of my day typically is like, is bang my head monotonous. And then we discover something and it's incredibly amazing.
That's Todd Bookman from the health and science show The Pulse. The podcast is on iTunes. It can be hard to relate to someone who has dementia, whether that's Alzheimer's or another form. It's not something we can see, and it might be tough for the person experiencing it to explain what they're going through. That's why a retirement community in Phoenix hosted what it calls a virtual dementia tour earlier today in hopes of helping people understand what the condition is like to live with. The show's Annika Klein was there.
You won't get hurt. You won't get mentally altered or anything like that, but I'm going to make you have dementia for like 10 minutes.
And that's how Dennis Murphy introduces the virtual dementia tour. Murphy's the program manager for the memory support program at the Terraces Retirement Community. He works with residents who live with dementia, but here he's addressing some staff members and family members of residents.
So first we're going to put in the shoe inserts, pokey side up.
The tour focuses on altering the senses. So we put on glasses that make it tough to see, shoe inserts that make it tough to walk, gloves that make it tough to use your hands, and headphones connected to an iPod that plays this.
You'll be asked to perform 5 simple tasks.
We enter an apartment, and Murphy lists off what I need to do.
Find the book and turn to page 73. Set the dinner table for 4.
Okay. Oh, man. It's slow going. And suddenly it seems daunting to do 5 small things in 10 minutes.
It was very challenging.
Allison Blondell just finished her tasks. She's an activity coordinator at the Terraces and says the tour helped her think of how she might interact with residents differently in the future.
Take more time and allow those with dementia longer time that was needed to carry out a simple task.
Dennis Murphy wants the tour to build empathy for those living with dementia. I point out to him that the tour just affects the senses. I'm still me under the gloves and headphones. But he says you can look at dementia the same way.
Every dementia resident is different. There is no one dementia. Every individual has their own likes, dislikes, different symptoms of where the dementia is hitting in the brain. So it's going to be different no matter who you are.
And that's also what makes it so hard to recognize dementia in the first place if you don't know what you're looking for. Carol Melillo says she had no idea her mother-in-law had it when she was caring for her.
We flew blind for too long.
It was an emotional experience. Melillo says her mother-in-law was saying and doing strange things she didn't know how to deal with.
Looking back, had we known what was going on, we could have dealt with it in a far more objective, efficient, helpful way.
Even though the people here, like Melillo, are already familiar with dementia on some level, Murphy says there's a difference between knowing and experiencing.
The immediate wow factor is the huge thing, because I had no idea that they heard all this. I had no idea they felt this. I had no idea how confused you can be with all of this stuff going on.
He says that wow factor fades with time, so he plans to bring the tour back to the Terraces every couple of years. For the show, I'm Annika Klein.
That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Mark Brody. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.